Regarding the Council of Nicaea, were there some people at that time called Arians, who perhaps we would think of as early day Jehovah's Witnesses, and it was them who really provoked the, you know, made responsible the reason why they debated Jesus' divinity at the Council of Nicaea, not that it was decided by a vote because they didn't believe he was divine. You know, the church fathers didn't, you know, they had to make that decision there. You know, some people are out more challenging that claim at the time.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The debate really was Jesus, if you like, the same as God, or was he the first of the created beings? And the Arians were those who believed that he was the first of the created beings. If you had asked people on either side of the debate, is Jesus the Son of God, they would all have said yes, whatever side of the debate they were on. So it was about what that meant, not about whether Jesus was the Son of God. The other thing that I think is worth picking up is that the Orthodox Christian position, the statement of the Orthodox Christian position about Jesus' divinity that came out of the Council of Nicaea, which is accepted today by Catholics and Protestants and Eastern Orthodox, all accepted, the Nicene Creed, was the vote for that was not, it wasn't a very close vote, as Dan Brown says. It was a vote of 318-4 to 2 against. Okay.
To be fair, Constantine did put a little bit of pressure on, didn't he? Because actually there were 17 bishops who were a little reluctant, and Constantine did, to be fair to Dan Brown, threaten exile, and so it went from 17 against to 2 against. So it was a little closer. It was 300 against 17.
I was just going to make a comment about the women's issues that came up from Dan Brown, but to me,
Yes, absolutely. Proverbs 31 is coming right at the end of the book of Proverbs. There's a passage about this, as you say, an almost superhuman woman who organises a home and sorts out everything in life. She's just brilliant. Just like my wife, of course. Yes, you're making the point that wouldn't be in there if Christianity had been really so anti-women. I think that's right. There are many other things like that as well. Very significantly, it's Jesus' own attitude to women. Jesus was totally unlike anybody else of his time. He had women in his entourage following him round, independent women of clearly with their own means, not dependent on husbands or fathers, including Mary Magdalene, who Luke tells us was following Jesus around and was one of the people helping to support Jesus in his ministry. He revealed himself after the resurrection first to women in a culture when women's testimony wasn't valid in court. Many of Paul's writings, it seems clear that women had a very high place within the early church. Yes, we've got it wrong down through history, but it's not there in the basis of our faith, the Bible. That's not what gives grounds to it. So I think it is an important point. Thank you. Yes, they do, but it's the other Mary, of course, or one of the other Marys. This is part of the problem with talking about Mary in the New Testament, because seem to be several of them. But yes, the Catholic Church has had a very high view of Mary, the mother of Jesus, and have, certainly at times in their history, exalted her to virtually be on the same level as Christ himself. And some of the things that have been taught at times in Catholic history have been unjustified by the Bible, and the Protestant Church has reacted against that so strongly that we pretty much ignore her, which is we shouldn't do, really. I mean, she still deserves our respect. So the Protestant Church have largely ignored Mary, but the Catholic Church have had a very high place for her, and still does in many parts. And as you say, that really does go against what he's saying about the Catholic Church's respect for women, you know, any woman in particular. Yeah. Thank you.
Good evening. Just a point on the Apostles' marriage. At the time, he turned a teacher,
sorry, could you unpack that question a bit? I took it from what you were saying that behind that there lies the idea that the wedding at Cana of Galilee is actually Jesus' own wedding.
Yes.
Why would we think that? Because the Bible doesn't say that at all.
Because they refer to him as the servants refer to him as master. You have to maintain master. If he wasn't their master, they would refer to him as master.
I'd need to look back at what he actually says there, but I would just take it from master as a sign of respect. I don't think it necessarily means you're my master in that sense. And I think it would be very odd if it's Jesus' own way. The document doesn't say that at all, and it talks about him and his followers being among the guests, which, you know, mean you're not the guest of your own wedding, it's a bit important.
But they would be guests of his
wedding. I can't see it there. This is in John chapter 2, if you want to have a look. Jesus' mother says to Jesus, when the wine has run out, they've got no more wine. But that's not, that isn't suggesting that he's the man in charge, but just that she thinks that he can do something about it, because of course she's known of Jesus' extraordinary birth. She was intimately involved in it. And Jesus says to her, "Dear woman, why do you involve me? My time hasn't yet come." His mother says to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." So there she's putting him into a position of authority. She's instructing the servants, saying, if you listen to him, it'll be all right. So Jesus gives them instructions to fill the jars, to take them to the master of the banquet. The master of the banquet tasted the water, discovers it's been turned into wine. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you've saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory and his disciples put their faith in him. Now that reference, so the servants actually don't call him master. There is a mention of the master of the banquet. And although Jesus tells them what to do, that's because they're in a crisis, they're urged to do so. And then it refers separately to the bridegroom. There's nothing to suggest there that the bridegroom is Jesus himself. But that rabbis in the New Testament times weren't always married anyway. Jesus wasn't an established and accepted rabbi. He taught, but in one or two discussions he has with people, he clearly doesn't have the status of an official rabbi. And as David pointed out earlier, there was this community at Qumran, the Essenes, who were celibate. There were a number of apocalyptic preachers around at the time who in many ways were similar to Jesus in the way that they went around. And they also were celibate. Jesus talks about celibacy at one point with the implication that he is the model of it in Matthew 18, I think it is. So I think there's a number of bits of evidence that that he probably wasn't married, with no positive evidence for. But I also want to say, actually, does it make any difference? Dan Brown makes a big deal of it, but the Orthodox Christian position is that Jesus was fully human as well as fully divine. And if he was married, if he did have a child, that would just be an expression of his humanity. It doesn't make him sinful or anything less if he was to be married. I don't think the evidence is there, but I actually don't think it's a big deal anyway.
Going back to the last speaker, John chapter 2, specifically in the first verse, Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus said to his disciples that also been invited to the wedding.
Yes.
So I was never invited to the wedding.
Yes, I skipped over the first verse, thank you, David.
To celebrate my marriage to my wife who's still with me. So it would be very unusual to say that somebody went to the wedding, his own wedding, invited, and it always happens. Now, I think it would be the whole story as a whole. It's not the end of the story. So I think you can dismiss that one. But can I also say that having been looking at this problem, the whole problem recently on the truthfulness of the gospel of what we believe, I've been very impressed by the coherence of all the books in the New Testament from Matthew right through. Let's just go up to the end of Paul's writing. You fit those together. And you see the book of the Acts, which is a marvelously historical book. It could be tied up with Roman history, such as the deed he wrote, the dates of it, and all those events are so wonderfully historical. And the most excellent historian writing this with accuracy and determination to present the truth. And when you consider what he's got about the preaching and the sermons that are there, if you read what Paul said in all his letters, refer to some of them this evening, tied up with what Jesus and others said in the gospel, there's a magnificent coherence about it. I think the onus is on other people to disprove this coherence and this truth which the church has historically proclaimed for so many years.
Thank you.